This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we talk about weed in Atlanta. Now, if you're caught with an ounce or less of marijuana, you pay a fine instead of going to jail. So what do you think? Good idea? Or is this letting people off too easily? Give us a call and leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for that conversation. So how did you sleep last night? If you didn't get a restful 7 hours or so, my next guest may know why. Emory University professor Ben Reese says a good night's rest can be spoiled by a lot of things that we can't control. His newest book is called Wild Nights: How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. It was released in March. Ben joined us in May to talk about the effects of science and history on sleep. Good night of rest?
Pretty good. Yeah, not too bad.
Have you always had good sleep?
No. I've gone through periods of having really poor sleep, and I've had some periods where it's just come to me magically.
So what led you to this? You teach English, right, at Emory? What led you to sleep?
Well, I've been interested for a long time in connections between humanities and the health sciences, and I think, humanities is often the under-examined side of the way we live our lives, and things that perplex us in contemporary world have histories that people in the humanities like myself can shed some light on. So I was really fascinated by why people seem so obsessed by sleep. Why in a time in our society when there's more restful and safe and hygienic sleeping conditions available to more people than ever before in human history, why so many people feel like they can't do it correctly. They have to train their children how to do it and sort of retrain themselves, put themselves under surveillance at night with sleep trackers. We were talking about this earlier.
I have a sleep tracker.
Yeah,
sure.
Right. I mean, so why do we, it's a basic human activity. Why all the fuss around it? And it seemed to me that it was something that the literary record, the documentary record of history could shed some light on.
So what was your first revelation? What was your first aha moment?
Well, the first aha moment was that, yes, true, 6 to 9 hours is the recommended amount, but there's nothing in nature that tells us that you're supposed to do it all at once. And the way that we're told to sleep from a very early age onward in our society is to kind of bundle all our sleep together into one package and do it all at night. And through most of the history of the species, sleep was broken up into several different components. Different cultures had different ways of, expecting, when and where people were supposed to sleep. But almost no society before around the 19th century in Europe and North America expected that people would do all their sleeping at once. Sleep scientists will tell us that naturally, we wake up 4 or 5 times in the middle of the night, even if we think we slept 6 to 9 hours. We've actually woken up a number of times, checking the pillow, turning over, and so on. And for some people,
kicking the dog,
kicking your bedmate, checking your phone, whatever you do. Some of us don't really notice that happening. Others get up and then think, oh my God, I have insomnia.
The headline that's come out of this book, and I want to say it's the headline because the book is quite far reaching in terms of how far it goes into. But one of the things that has come out is that African Americans get less sleep than whites do. And you quote in there Thomas Jefferson, who said that black people simply require less sleep than whites. Why would an African American get less sleep now in 2017 than a colleague who's white?
Well, there are a lot of things that are unknown about that, but it's been widely documented in public health studies that there's something called a racial sleep gap, where we talk about that 6 to 9 hour recommended window for sleep. And African Americans are much less likely than whites to get that amount, both because more of them sleep less than 6 hours than white people do, and also because more sleep more than 9 hours, which can also be unhealthy, can be associated with depression and other kind of health problems. But, there are a lot of reasons for this, and many of them have to do with broken sleep environments. African Americans are more likely to live in noisy environments, overcrowded environments, unsafe environments, to work chaotic or unpredictable or undesirable work shifts that make it hard to sleep in an unbroken way at night. And so there are a lot of stressors on sleep that are quite different across the races.
And then again, that it ends up having all kinds of impact on their daily life when they are awake. And one thing which was very interesting, you point to the research of, I'm remembering the name, Tiffany Yip?
Yes.
At Fordham, who studies the effects of sleep on kids in school and how it can, beginning in the early grades, this can follow them through their entire school experience in terms of just not getting enough sleep changes an A student into a C or D student.
That's right. And one of the things she was really interested in is what are the effects of experiences of ethnic discrimination on young people, and how a negative encounter during the day can really profoundly affect somebody's sleep. And then it has carryover effects into the next day in terms of concentration or motivation or mood. And things can quite quickly snowball so that the a problem or a conflict creates a broken sleep pattern. And then that broken sleep pattern makes the student less equipped to kind of carry on in the next day.
Yeah, if you bring this back just to the granular level, you're imagining this kid, this 8-year-old kid maybe in school, who gets called a racial slur at school. That affects their sleep that night, but then it happens again the next day and affects their sleep. So it becomes this cycle where they're just not getting enough sleep, which means they're going to perform less well in school. They're going to have less healthy relationships with other people, because lack of sleep also affects your ability to be friendly, even,
yeah,
or have empathy.
Yeah, and where I went with this in my own research, and you mentioned that startling quote from Thomas Jefferson, is to say there's a history to the sleep gap and to the differences in expectations around sleep that go back to our history of racial inequality as a slaveholding nation. And Thomas Jefferson, of course, was a slaveholder, and he was looking in on a chronically exhausted population and saying, well, they require less sleep. And then he also noticed in his writing, he said, well, at the end of a long day's work, the African American people on the plantation would fall asleep immediately. And he didn't attribute this to overwork or to physical exhaustion. He attributed it to a kind of intellectual insufficiency, that they couldn't keep themselves awake through powers of reflection to engage in intellectual activity and so on. So essentially justifying the chronic exhaustion of a dominated population by saying, well, their bodies are just different and they don't need to sleep as much.
So do you feel like you, after all of this research that you did you come to a better understanding over why? There's two things here, two questions it sounds like you started with. One, why are we so obsessed with sleep? And two, why aren't we getting enough? Did you get answers to those two questions?
Yeah, well, one of the answers that I got to the second question about why aren't we getting enough has to do with asking who the we is, right? And often these questions are asked in a way that presumes a sort of middle class, economically comfortable person who's struggling with sleep psychologically. But when you look at kind of the broad span of sleeping practices and arrangements, for many people, the reason why they're not getting enough sleep is more simple and elemental than that, and that is they can't afford to. To be poor is to be chronically sleep deprived, and there are people, across the world who are sleeping in very strange kind of patterns. Think about tech workers in India who are working in call centers catering to the technological needs of those of us here in the U.S. They've got to be working at 3-4 in the morning. Whole sectors of the economy have profound sleep disturbances. So I started dividing up who that we is and looking at different communities of sleepers and really what they struggle with.
So to a certain extent, this sleep obsession and anxiety is a privilege of wealth and sometimes race.
It is, in a way, and we buy our way into it, right? I mean, you have your sleep tracker. People have smart beds that monitor how much we perspire and move in the night. You can have anti-snore pillows, you know, all kinds of devices to sort of customize our sleep and try to optimize it for us, as well as, you know, multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical industry that we can use to tinker with our sleep. And that's to sort of cater toward these expectations towards sleep that again, as we talked about, are pretty historically novel. But for many people, they can't buy their way into it, and they're just left to sweep up whatever scraps of sleep they can find, in their condition.
That was Emory University professor Ben Rees. His latest book is Wild Nights: How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. It's a pretty good time to be a sleep scientist. Earlier this week, three scientists won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for their work on circadian rhythm. That's also sometimes called the biological clock. It controls, among a number of other things, sleep. Joining us now is Assistant Professor of Neuroscience at Morehouse School of Medicine, Chris Allen. He was not on the Nobel Prize-winning team, but he's part of a team who just released their own findings about sleep. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I think we should emphasize, at this point, these are very preliminary findings, because there's no human trials yet.
Right. We've only done this in mouse.
But tell me what you found in mice with their sleep.
Okay. So we were interested in a gene. It's called BMOL1. And we knew that this gene, when it was turned off in a mouse, or we call it knocked out, it would increase the amount of sleep they had. And so we wanted to look into this further and figure out how this was going on. And long story short, what we found is that when we rescued it in the muscle, so we turned it off in the entire mouse and then rescued it in the muscle.
Turned it back on just for muscle tissue.
Turned it back on just in muscle tissue, that we saw a normal amount of sleep. Whereas when we rescued it in the brain, we still saw that increased sleep amount that we saw with the whole body knockout. So in essence, the data tell us that muscle is responsible for this effect of this gene BMOL1.
And this is surprising because for as long back as neuroscience research has been going on, we thought sleep was the province only of the brain, right?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, we're neuroscientists, so we tend to focus on the brain.
Yeah. A hammer, everything looks like a nail, right?
Right. I talk to some of my friends and they say, duh, that, you know, everybody else seems to know that the body has something to do with sleep. But we were very, very surprised. And honestly, we thought there was something wrong. And we went through a series of experiments where we conditionally knocked it out in the muscle. And we really went through a bunch of steps to verify that BMOL1 in the muscle is necessary and sufficient to regulate sleep amount.
So something about our muscle tissue itself is regulating whether we get enough sleep or we don't get enough sleep. That was sort of these preliminary findings.
Right.
So what is your next step? Because this, as I said, for me at least, brings up more questions than answers. So what are your next questions?
Right. So we're really interested in what kind of communication is going on between the muscle and the brain. And one of the things I didn't tell you about this BMOL1 is that BMOL1 is a core gene involved in the circadian clock. So it is critical for the functioning of the circadian clock. So it could be that clocks in muscle are actually what is regulating the sleep amount. Or the BMOL1 could be acting outside of the clock and doing something else. So genes could have more than one role, and that happens frequently.
And, I mean, it's only in mice, but do we have any inkling yet of whether or not the activity of the muscle during the day has anything to do with how that regulates sleep or doesn't regulate sleep? In other words, a more active mouse versus a more lazy mouse.
Yeah, well, we have some evidence in humans. So we know exercise improves sleep quality. So if you exercise during the day, it doesn't improve sleep quality at night. as long as you don't do it within 2 hours before sleep, and then it interferes with your sleep.
Because that wakes you up.
Right.
Right. But your evidence suggests that that's not merely a brain phenomenon, that actually may be happening in the muscle itself.
Right. So, yeah, it might be that some factor from the muscle is actually being released into the blood or somehow communicating with the brain. And that's what we're interested in figuring out, what that factor is. Is it a chemical? Is it some kind of neural communication?
Why is it so hard for us to understand sleep? Because at this point, we don't even know what the purpose of sleep is, right?
Exactly. And why is it so hard?
Yeah, why don't we know? We know it's important because as far as we know, like almost every single species sleeps.
Right. I mean, almost every organism from flies to humans sleep. And I don't know why it's so hard. I suppose it's because we don't really have a way of looking at sleep outside of what the cognitive effects are, right? So
we can just watch the brain and what it's doing.
Right. I mean, we can do electroencephalography where we measure electrical waves on the surface of the brain, but as far as
what the evolutionary purpose is, how would we figure it out?
Right.
Right?
Yeah. So we don't really know what the evolutionary
purpose is.
Maybe
in 1,000 years as we watch the body evolve. We might see how it changed. I don't know. There's a lot of questions about sleep, more questions than answers. And I assume that your investigations will continue as you move forward with the muscle tissue. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We're going to keep working on it.
That's Chris Ellen, Assistant Professor of Neuroscience. More to come from the Morehouse School of Medicine. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, but let's hear from you. We talked earlier about the Equifax hack and how basically everyone is affected by it, whether you think that you are or not. So how do you think this should be handled by the government? Should those responsible for dropping the ball at Equifax pay a fine, go to jail? What should the punishment be? Call us at 404-500-9457, leave a message, or post to Facebook and Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.